Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Tom Kerr. Kerr received his PhD in English from the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee. He is currently an associate professor in the Department of Writing at Ithaca College. In 2003, Professor Kerr put out a call for correspondence with U.S. prisoners for one of his rhetoric and writing classes. One of the prisoners who responded was Steve Champion, who had been writing essays about his time in prison and on death row in San Quentin in California. Kerr eventually helped Champion put together his collection of essays, and the result is a very powerful memoir called Dead to Deliverance, a death row memoir by Steve Champion. It was published by Split Oak Press with an introduction by Professor Kerr. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I want to ask you first, Tom, what motivated you back in 2003 to put out this call to start corresponding with prisoners?
Well, I was teaching a senior seminar in focused on the rhetoric of social movements, and what I was interested in the seminar was to understand what kinds of writing drives social movements. Mm. But I didn't want to take on a variety of social movements, and I was interested in the prison industrial complex. So I took the movement against the prison industrial complex mm-hmm. as a case study. And we began looking at the kinds of writing that people were doing, activists, prisoners, academics, politicians, mm-hmm. sociologists, against the prison system. And what happened was my students sort of, I told the students at the beginning that it wasn't a debate class, it wasn't an issues class. We were looking at the rhetoric that was, and the writing especially, that mm-hmm. was driving this movement.
And then prisoners weren't always heard from in this whole realm,
Right, yeah. But what happened was the class actually couldn't get over the content of the writing that we were reading, which was quite radical to them and which questioned everything they'd ever thought or believed about criminal justice in the United States, and went really to who they were and who prisoners were. So they rebelled, and we were often reading published essays by people who were incarcerated or who had previously been incarcerated. And my students were in disbelief. They found it incredulous that some of the stories and accounts, they didn't believe the prisoners, and the line was sort of, well, why should we believe these writers? They're criminals. They have every reason to lie.
You know, that's an attitude of a lot of people, yeah. as you probably know.
And finish that thought, so my response was, hey, let's put out a call and have a direct dialogue with these people and see if that changes the way you feel about their critique of the system.
Ah. Well, you must have heard from quite a few prisoners. Why did Steve Champion jump out at you and become such a cause?
About 30 people wrote us in that class, and we responded to them all and had a dialogue. Steve had been writing for some years, and so he identified himself as a writer in his letter to us and mm-hmm. and included several essays that he had in the works and a couple of published essays, I believe, and asked me if I'd be interested in working with him. So what struck me was that he was an emergent writer, and I also liked the way he approached writing. He wrote short essays about very specific subjects, and so I kind of liked his writing style, and so I agreed to work with him to see if we could publish some essays.
The book is absolutely fascinating. To tell our audience a little bit about Steve, you know, he's on death row. He's been there for 30 years now, hasn't he?
It's 31 years.
Oh, gosh.
It's unbelievable.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Steve grew up in South Central Los Angeles. He's 50 years old. He got into the gang life at an early age, 11,
and
12.
Need we say he's African-American from South Central LA.
African-American. Yeah. Uh-huh. So he dropped out of school in junior high, just went into the streets, became an active Crip, found belonging and power with that gang that had formed in the 70s.
Yeah. And he was fatherless, which helped him to need to find a place for himself.
That's right. His father left before he was born, and then he had a stepfather that came and went, and another man that he doesn't even remember. So,
yeah.
I think that...
So he joined the gangs to belong and to feel power.
Which he writes about in the memoir.
Yeah.
In the essay Growing Up Crip.
So in the course of a robbery, people were killed and he was convicted of murder.
Yes, he was convicted of a double homicide in the course of a robbery, so that's the special circumstance which allowed for the death penalty.
Yeah, he was
18 at the time this crime occurred, and he was sent to death row at 20.
In 1982. Imagine that. You know what's something that you say in the introduction to this book is that Steve's innocence or guilt is not a pivotal question for you. To tell us why, because it would be for so many.
When I encountered Steve in 2003 in his letters, I encountered a man very, very different from the boy that is represented in the trial transcripts, mm-hmm. which I've read. So I encountered a person that I could relate to in the same way I'm relating to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when I've met Steve at San Quentin in a similar context, in a small room together, we were able to talk for 4 hours without missing a beat. So I understand that he was one person when he was 18 and 19, and he's another person now, and so somehow I allow for people to change. I mean, I know I have changed radically.
And he even talks about in his book that he doesn't think it's right to judge somebody by the worst moment of their life, and that being the whole being of their existence.
It's
an interesting point.
It's complicated.
It is.
Violent crime, and so. If he is guilty, and I haven't made a determination, I mean, I have my own ideas, but I don't talk about it, you know. Whether he's guilty or innocent, I would work with him in the same way, because I'm looking forward. He and I are both interested in understanding racism in this culture, the conditions in which, how could Steve grow up the way he did, and I grow up the way I did, which was very different, upper middle class, white,
Colorado,
with all kinds of opportunities, present father.
So in some ways you're looking at it from a sociological perspective rather than a criminal investigation.
Yeah, and a personal, sociological and personal.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit, because there has been a lot of talk about the prison industrial complex, as many call it. We incarcerate more adults in this country than any industrial country, 1 in 33 or something. It's outrageous. So tell us what your thoughts are about that at this point.
Well, I got into teaching about prisons as I'm a writing instructor, and I was teaching writing, and I realized in the 90s while teaching at Syracuse University that my middle class students would generally take enlightened or progressive views of all kinds of social issues, from animal rights to, I don't know, back in the 90s, what was on the... Maybe gay marriage was there.
And always environmental issues.
Environmental, thank you.
Walking through as well, yeah.
Health. So we were doing a reader that had all these different issues. And when we got to Crime and Punishment, which was the title of the unit, I realized everybody was hardcore, sort of right-wing, law and order kind of. And it was very surprising to me.
Yeah.
So how can you be for animal rights and so harsh when it comes to punishment and retribution for prisoners? And, you know, the line was, if they do the time, they should do the crime. If they do the crime, you should do the time.
Yeah,
So I was struck that they had been persuaded in culture through television, movies, political speech to hold these views that were sort of in contradiction to their general ideology. And so what I think is that in this country we have we embrace a retributive ideology, a punishing ideology, and think that that's how we should address crime, and that And now people are profiting off of prisons and all the services and things that go along with it. So it goes along with capitalism. We can make money off prisoners. Some prisoners refer to themselves or call the new prisons that are built out in impoverished rural areas prison farming, people farming.
Yeah.
People farming.
Yeah, I know. It has become a big business in this
country. So there's a whole, like, industry. So the prison industrial complex, that term is very appropriate.
Yeah.
Coined by Angela Davis, I believe.
Oh, yeah. She's written quite a few good books on the prison system. Let's talk more about that restorative justice rather than our current, you know, retribution that we're always asking for from people in prison. So talk to us a little bit more about that. What would it be?
Well, in the case of, at the most basic level, I think restoration has to happen through some kind of a dialogue. And anytime we injure one another, even if it's in a marriage or with my daughter, if I hurt her feelings, we want to restore the relationship. So we would talk about it and share feeling, have a dialogue. So for me, at the core, restorative justice is it's the opposite sort of corporeal punishment with children, where you spank. Rather than spanking the child, you talk to the child and figure out how to restore the community and the order and the good feelings that existed before.
Yeah. And you explain parameters and you try to get them to understand about respect.
Yeah, you're not putting them out of the community or out of the society. So you're trying to keep them in. So it gets more complicated with violent crime. Obviously, when somebody hurts somebody or kills somebody, it's not just about feelings anymore, or properties, or all kinds of things. So restoration would still be based on dialogue, and you would. In the case of violent crime, you may not be able to have a dialogue between the perpetrator and the victim. That may not be possible, but there could be a context in which at least the society is discussing the nature of that crime and how the person who committed the crime might restore him or herself to a better place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about dialogue, I think. And then it gets to be about institutions, and you have to, for another form of restorative justice is drug courts, where instead of putting nonviolent offenders who are poor and selling drugs or addicted to drugs into prison and giving them a felony rap, which will follow them for the rest of their lives, you would bring them into a drug court and try to get them into treatment and try to restore them to a position that would be good for them and the rest of us.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty much of a sketch of restorative justice.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge paradigm shift.
Yeah, well, it's something that we would have to think deeply about, too, because nobody's even really talking about
using that as a
substitute for putting people on death row and throwing the key away, right?
Right, yeah.
I want to talk to you about... Steve says in his book that the geography of death row is located more in the region of the psyche than inside some concrete structure. Tell us what your feelings have been. You've visited him in San Quentin. What does it feel like?
Well, it feels horrible. So what Steve is saying there, I think, is that everybody that's put on death row has to figure out how to deal with it mentally, the physical condition,
and to keep your humanity.
Yeah,
going back to that.
Yeah, insanity.
Yeah.
So I think he's trying there to talk about how if you're going to survive on death row, you have to become very strong spiritually, whether that's religious or not. But you have to turn inward. They have a wonderful. He and his co-defendant Anthony Ross wrote a wonderful pamphlet for prisoners coming into death row titled, "Everything You Value, You Must Carry Without Hands," to say, which is goes to the point that when you're captured and held in a cell and moved around arbitrarily very often, you can't your belongings mean nothing, and so you have to... everything you value, you must carry without hands. And I think this is also the geography of death row is mental.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Professor Tom Kerr. We're talking about his relationship with a death row inmate named Steve Champion. He ended up writing a book called Death to Deliverance, a death row memoir, and Professor Kerr helped him put that book together and wrote the introduction. We're talking about this case. Talk to us about what you've seen in regard to, obviously, Steve Champion decided to educate himself, got into learning. Tell us how that changed his life, and what does that tell you about teaching?
Well, his story is amazing because he's an autodidact with his two friends, Stanley Tookie Williams, who was executed in December of 2005, and his other friend, Anthony Ross, formed a study group in the early days, in the late 80s and 90s, when they're in death row. And just determined that they would give themselves a college education, essentially, by collecting books, reading them, and talking about them. And eventually, reading and talking wasn't enough, and they all decided they wanted to write. And this is how Steve became a writer. It's fabulous. So, you know, what I learn about teaching, I think, through Steve's experience, or what that says to me, is how important it is for students, whether it's somebody on death row or in a classroom in Ithaca College, to find their own motive, to find some reason and have some need to learn. Mm-hmm. That it has to come from them somehow, which for me as a my pedagogy is sort of reflects that, in that I very often go into a classroom without predetermined subject matter. So I'll be teaching a class in argument, for example, and I'll say to the class, okay, we're going to spend the first 3 weeks figuring out what you want to talk about and argue about, and what's interesting to you. And so in a way, I think that's one thing I've learned from, I mean, it reinforces a belief I already had, that we learn by doing and for reasons that are our own rather than the institution.
Oh, yeah, and an education does keep you alive, you know? I mean, it keeps you wanting to be a human being and continue to grow. And
yeah, and I would say that Steve had to do it by himself because all the programming in prisons in the last 25, not all but most, has been stripped away because of the hardcore.
And he started out having to start from almost square one. I mean, he dropped out of school pretty much
early on,
mentally,
yeah.
by the time he was, what, seventh grade?
Seventh grade, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, so he had a huge, and he's, you know, the book, he's interested in everything, religions, history. He's particularly interested in history.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to me.
Political economics and international policy.
You know, this kind of a case, and you talking about it and you getting involved in it, and I know a lot of people have gotten involved in the prison system trying to make changes. Angela Davis was mentioned. But there seems to be so much revenge still going on in this country, this vicious feeling that you see it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was really interesting that Steve brought up the case of Nelson Mandela, who was considered, he was considered a thug.
Mm-hmm.
He was put in jail for 27 years.
Right.
And now he's thought of as a saint. So, you know, that's a case where you can redeem yourself, and we need to keep bringing those kind of cases up, because people forget. They just think criminals are bad people, period, nothing else.
Yeah, criminal is reduced to a stereotype, and you lose your humanity, and this then allows us to keep 2.2 million people in prison, because they're not really fully human to us.
Yeah.
So we don't mind that they're suffering
and
grievously.
And it's a vicious cycle, too, because they have no chance to redeem themselves in so many prison settings.
Right. It's very striking to me that we have a Judeo-Christian culture that is founded on forgiveness and redemption, and yet when it comes to prisons and social and crime and social policy, it's a complete schizophrenic
and
position.
And so many industrialized countries don't do that anymore.
That's
true. You know, I mean, most of Western Europe, Northern Europe,
that's
so much different.
You know, I work with another man who committed a murder in a New Folsom prison, who's helped me have other correspondence between Ithaca College students and prisoners in California.
Mm.
He committed murder when he was 19. He's now a poet and writer. His name is Spoon Jackson, and you can look him up. You can Google him and find his books and poetry. And his point is, he's now just being warehoused for life. He's completely transformed himself. He's a poet and writer. He's a beautiful person. He feels that 10 years, he could have been taken out of society maybe for 10 years, and been punished sufficiently, mm-hmm. and that after that, it's all about just warehousing and making money off of his body.
And revenge in many ways. What would you say, though, to the families of people who've been affected by some of these moments in time when these people were bad people?
Yeah, that's a really good question for me, because I think if I had been a victim of a horrible, violent crime, intimate, close up, I may not be doing this work. It may be that you do what you can, when you can, where you can, and depending on circumstances. Uh-huh. And so, thankfully, I haven't experienced a direct sort of violent crime in my life. Mm-hmm. What I say to people, what you hear from people, many families of murder victims, is that once the death penalty is carried out, it doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
Their feelings don't change much.
Yeah.
You hear other families who have been victims of violent crime actually enter a dialogue with the perpetrator, and it can be transformative.
Mm-hmm.
The person can actually help them heal. So I think it's really complicated.
Oh, it is.
Where you are. And I guess what I would say to people is that, you know, maybe personally, revenge is something that would feel good, but you don't want your state to enact revenge. Like I often think, if somebody I know closely was murdered, I might be so angry that I couldn't get out of that place, but I wouldn't want my state to take those emotions. I would want my state to be dispassionate and to try to preserve human dignity all along the way, because otherwise it's just a cycle of retribution. I mean, it's sort of what happens in the gang world
I think the death penalty is problematic too. I mean, I understand putting people life in prison if people are uncomfortable with that, you know, the families. But the death penalty is so arbitrary and so capricious.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we have this Innocence Project now. They're showing that they've got so many innocent people on death mm-hmm. row, many of them disproportionately black men.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with racism. So
yes,
the death penalty, to me, is the most problematic thing. Did you ever feel afraid when you'd go visit these prisons?
Well, let me say, first of all, the death penalty has also been something I've opposed my whole life since I was small.
Mm-hmm.
So one another reason that I wanted to work with Steve was I felt that my feeling about this is, if we can bring voices of people like Steve out of death row, where we're told that only monsters live,
mm-hmm.
not people,
mm-hmm.
if we can hear the human voices and that some empathy can be created through that's one way to deconstruct the death penalty,
uh-huh.
to attack it, is just to understand who that we're killing people. For me the death penalty doesn't make any sense at all. It's if somebody hits you, we don't tell the child. If one child hits another, we don't say hit them back, knock them down.
Well, some idiots
some do.
But
that's,
no, in general,
that's
we
true. But the idea that,
yes.
that to you would mm-hmm. teach society
an eye for an
not
eye.
To kill by killing is mm-hmm. kind of remarkable to me.
Yeah. Did you ever feel threatened when you go visit some of these places?
Well, I've been in Auburn. With students. I took some students there back in the 90s. No, I have not felt threatened, I must say. Once you're in prison, and it's a very much like sort of everyday kind of place. It's an institution, like a school.
Yeah.
People are going about their business. There's a little ominous. There's guards, there's guns, a lot of warnings.
And then there are a lot of prisons treat people like animals, so they act accordingly,
Yeah, I never have felt afraid. And when I first met Steve, we met in a 6x8 cage with no guard inside the cage. We were locked in together. I had no fear.
Mm-hmm.
I'd come to know him through letters, so
yeah.
I felt very confident about that.
Tell us how Steve is right now. Is he still appealing?
I want to say, yes, he's still appealing. His case, his conviction has been affirmed by California, so his appeal is in the federal courts now, and it's just...
He's trying to get the death penalty overturned, right? He's not trying to get out of prison.
That's the first thing.
Yeah,
the death penalty. I don't know his whole plan. I think he probably would cherish freedom,
but of course.
I don't think that's probably in the picture.
Yeah.
So your question was, how is Steve now? So I just will tell you that in October he went on a hunger strike because Steve was held in solitary confinement in San Quentin for 7 years unjustly on false charges that he was going to retaliate for his friend's execution, he and several other people, and this was never going to happen. 7 years he's been held in administrative segregation.
Imagine.
He went on hunger strike in October, and we publicized that, and we were able to get the prison's attention, and they actually negotiated with him, and he has been now moved out of solitary confinement back to grade A condemned housing, which means he can now make phone calls. And I just want to say the first thing he desperately wanted after those 7 years was a typewriter. And so was the big deal. And of course, I've got him a typewriter. So he now, I think, he's optimistic, he's hopeful, he's working on a project with his co-defendant, Anthony Ross, and co-author. I'm looking at the manuscript now. It's a book called The Architect, and it's directed toward gang members, and it's about how to transform them, their lives and their communities. So he's trying to impart what he's learned to people that are in the position he was when he was 18, 19, 20.
That's great.
It's very
interesting.
That would be, and complex. It's complex to write a book to people who are probably not interested in reading. But they're working on that.
Oh, I think a lot of people would be interested in that.
I think a lot of people around it. It's directly addressed to gang members.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what you should be doing instead of what you are doing.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful book. It's about building community and...
It sounds like maybe a book version of Scared Straight. Remember that series?
It is a little.
That was on, that tried to keep kids out of prison. They just show all these big, tough guys.
Yeah, the difference is, it is like that. The difference is it has a critical consciousness, and it's informed by history, and it's an analytical. So instead of that kind of scary thing, it more approaches it as, you know, look what you're doing. Here's where it leads.
Yeah.
Here are the other kinds of things you can do.
Yeah, so it gives you alternatives.
Including
just,
to vote.
Because fear doesn't...
Don't give up your don't get a felony.
Because you have to give up
so that
vote.
You can vote.
Yeah. Tom, we only have a couple minutes left. Tell us how working with Steve has changed your life personally, not just as a teacher.
Well, I'd say it's profound. It's a sort of a profound resolution to growing up in a divided society where when I was a kid, I was terrified of black kids like Steve, who lived across Martin Luther King Boulevard in Denver, where... And my father was racist, and so I had exposure to that and was very uncomfortable with that in my life. And I think that my working, and I was also very afraid of prisons, and even when I was in my early 20s, I had a series of dreams of being nightmares where I was in prison, menaced by black men.
Wow.
I mean, so that racism had gotten inside of me in a way that was very horrible to me. So working with Steve has been very healing for me personally to work very closely with a black man on many projects we've worked on and have this very close understanding and friendship
has developed.
Developed, yeah. So I think that would be it, that it's been very healing and redemptive for me.
Wow, that's great. Can you give some contact information? Can people get in touch with Steve if they want to?
They can get in touch with Steve. They can write him at Steve Champion, C-58001, San Quentin State Prison, San Quentin, California, 97974.
That's great. And I'm sure he would welcome letters, comments.
He welcomes letters
dialogue.
Very much.
That's great.
He'll respond.
Well, Tom Kerr, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for sharing this story. It's an incredibly important story to get out there right now.
Thanks a lot, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.